From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're tracking Hurricane Irma as it heads northwest through the Caribbean. The Category 5 storm made landfall early this morning with the eye of the storm passing over Antigua and Barbuda. There are reports of minimal damage to those islands, but the storm continued to St. Martin, where it sustained 185-mile-per-hour winds, and officials say the four most solid buildings on the island have been destroyed. The threat of Irma hitting Florida later this week still looms, and in a press conference this morning, the governor there, Rick Scott, said Irma should be taken seriously.
In Florida, we prepare for potential storms all year, and Irma is no different. Every family needs to have a plan, have a disaster preparedness kit, and be ready today. Do not sit and wait. Prepare right now. Don't watch the path. Assume right now it's going to impact the entire state.
Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. He joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon.
And Governor Scott is saying Floridians should not follow the storm's path on TV. But what do we know at this point about its path?
Well, its path is still highly uncertain beyond days three and beyond, certainly beyond day four. And it's day four and day five when it's going to be impacting the state of Florida the most. And keep in mind, when we get to day four, the average air on either side of the line that we all have a tendency to pay attention to, the average air on the left and the right side of the line is about 175 miles at day four. That puts it on Sunday. Then we get out to Monday, the average air on either side of the center of the cone is 225 miles. That is wider than the width of the Florida Peninsula. The Florida Peninsula is 160 miles wide, I think, at its, on average from north to south. So we're looking at an average air that's nearly twice the size of the Florida Peninsula. Keep that in mind. And that average air is for the center of the storm, not the impacts. So just keep that in mind as we approach the next couple of days and as we see changes to that forecast track.
Is there any indication at this point that the storm is weakening?
Unless it moves over land, it's unlikely to weaken significantly. The official forecast is for it to stay a Category 4 or a 5 and then possibly be a Category 4 when it approaches the state of Florida. So unless it moves over land, conditions are favorable for it to stay as strong as it is up until landfall.
Tell us about what's expected at this point in the Caribbean. We know that Puerto Rico is right in the line of fire.
Yeah, the northern shores of Puerto Rico are going to experience significant major hurricane conditions. The center of the storm appears to be, based on the newest GO-16 satellite scans I'm seeing, we're starting to reasonably have some confidence that it will stay offshore of Puerto Rico, the core of the hurricane. Mm-hmm. But it's large enough to have impacts on all of its sides. Remember, a major hurricane has significant impacts on all four quadrants of the storm. And that's important for the East Coast residents of Florida to remember. If you think the storm is going to be just a few miles offshore, we only have to think back to last year on how significant the damage can be from like Hurricane Matthew is the example, even if it stays 50 to 100 miles offshore.
Well, what are we expecting in Florida at this point? We've talked today with officials in the Keys where people are already evacuating in Miami Beach. The mayor there says he's asking people to evacuate. What do we know about where it might actually hit in Florida?
Well, it's important to remember, as I stated at the top of this segment, is that the forecast track of the center of the storm could easily shift at this point, easily shift dozens of miles. And just think for a minute the difference between Fort Myers and Naples and Miami. That's not a very long drive.
Right.
And if it's – so, Florida, the peninsula, is not an easy target when you move from south to north. Just a slight shift west or east is going to play dividends in terms of how significant the impacts will be in our entire state. Obviously, if a storm's coming at Florida from the left or right or the east or west, it's a much easier target, if you will. So I think what the governor is saying, what all the emergency managers are saying, especially in South and East Florida, and I've already spoken to several National Weather Service folks today. What they're saying is it's too early to get specific with this type of hazard's going to occur at this location. It's too early to get specific on the severity of that because that is certainly dependent upon the track. But I can say that starting today and especially by tomorrow, we'll have a much stronger understanding of the timing of all of this. And it's going to be approaching South Florida as early as Saturday morning and Central Florida as early as Sunday morning. And then the worst, if it hits North Florida, Florida would be Sunday night and Monday.
Well, and I know that you were telling us that people are already going to get their water bottles. The mayor of Miami Beach, though, said today, don't forget, you can fill up your water at home right now. The water is still good. That's Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thanks, Jeff.
You got it, Jeremy.
Well, to DACA now. Today, New York and other states are filing a lawsuit to protect the so-called dreamers that DACA served. Last night, President Trump seemed to tweet he wanted to protect them as well. The president wrote that if Congress fails to act on DACA, he will revisit his decision to rescind this program, which lets young people brought into the country illegally before 2007 live and work in the U.S. But today, the president appeared to be asked by off-mic reporters in the Oval Office if he has any second thoughts about his decision to rescind DACA. He said no. And yesterday, his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, said the program was illegal and unconstitutional. And he cited congressional testimony given by legal scholar Jonathan Turley to say DACA was overreach by President Obama. Let's take a look at some of these legal questions with Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, you do believe DACA is presidential overreach. Explain.
Well, I was very critical, not just of DACA, but other unilateral actions taken by President Obama. While I voted for President Obama, and I supported, and still do, many of his policies, this is a question not of the merits, but the means used by the president. President Obama tried to pass DACA and was unable to do so.
In Congress.
Correct. And so he turned around and achieved the same result unilaterally. And that's an option a president doesn't have.
Well, you know, about 100 legal scholars disagree with you and A.G. Sessions. They wrote to President Trump in August that federal courts have ruled a president can use prosecutorial discretion to give some immigrants temporary protected status. It has to do with a president's job to take care of things. And then in 2015, the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C. threw out former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio's claim that Obama overreached with DACA. That court said Arpaio couldn't show that the president's move harmed him.
Well, there's both scholars and cases on both sides. This is an issue, I think, of good faith disagreement. Mm. The Fifth Circuit struck down a program very similar to DACA, known as DAPA, on many of the same grounds that we're talking about now.
This was the program that would have allowed the parents of the Dreamers to stay, DAPA. But that court was also very clear that they were not striking down DACA.
I think that the point is that there are good faith reasons on both sides of this argument. I happen to believe that President Obama was wrong in that DACA is constitutionally flawed. And what I'm certain of is that this is an issue that will now return to the place it should have remained, which is Congress. I find it a little odd that people are suggesting that President Obama could use this authority to create DACA, but somehow President Trump can't use the authority to rescind it.
Look, so you're just talking about how DACA came to be. What about DACA itself? There's a multi-state lawsuit challenging it. We're reading it's a long shot because the president typically does have wide authority to implement immigration policy. You know, what about DACA itself? Are you saying that you think it should go through Congress and then would be legal?
I do. I believe that DACA can go through Congress and be unassailable from a constitutional standpoint. I also favor some type of protection for those protected under DACA. But in the Madisonian system, it's often as important how we do something as what we do. Now, certainly the tweet by President Trump is not going to help the case of his attorneys. This is a repeat of what we saw in the earlier immigration litigation. I mean, it's odd that Attorney General Sessions laid out a principled basis for sending this back to Congress. And within 10 hours, the president undermined that position by saying that he might do exactly what Obama did for the same reason, pass some type or order some type of DACA relief because Congress wouldn't pass what he asked. He actually reduced the pressure on Congress. So it's a rather confusing situation. It's not helpful for his attorneys, and it's certainly not helpful for his political position.
Jonathan, one last question. This all has come about because attorneys general were going to sue the White House. They are against DACA, and they were going to take it to court. There's reporting that Attorney General Sessions felt he couldn't defend it because he doesn't defend it. But others have said, why not let it go to court? You know, it has been upheld in the past. Do you think DACA would survive in the courts?
I think it would have been a very close question. I think that DACA is constitutionally flawed. I think you would have mixed responses from courts. It would have been a long litigation. The outcome would be uncertain.
One of the other things that scholars point to is that there have been, you know, these kind of Homeland Security missives or presidential missives regarding immigration in the past. There have been waivers, deferments of deportation. Why isn't that precedent?
Well, I think the argument here is that President Obama effectively negated a whole section of the immigration law, granted a type of amnesty for almost a million people.
And President Trump also mandated a ban on Muslims.
Yeah, so what would be really odd is that in any future litigation, it's very likely that you would have two presidents being cited by the opposing sides to support their cases.
Jonathan Turley, thank you. Thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org. The recovery goes on around hard-hit communities around Houston, families mucking out homes or displaced, not even back home yet. The Florida Keys are under evacuation. Tourists ordered out this morning. 70,000 residents at 7 o'clock tonight must leave as Hurricane Irma swirls like a grotesque fidget spinner through the Atlantic. What a terrible thing to be on the move. There are also people fleeing weather in Bangladesh, India. And as recent headlines reminded us, there are people fleeing conflict. We wanted to touch back in with the global migrant story that seems to have fallen off the radar. We recently met a group of students, five of them. They traveled from Syria, Yemen, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda, the first class of a new Global Scholars Program sponsored by the School for International Training in Brattleboro, Vermont. The program awards scholarships to people who've fled their home countries and then taken leadership roles in helping to alleviate the world's refugee crisis. This summer, we moderated a discussion among them. Bahati Kanyamanza from the Democratic Republic of Congo was only a boy when he fled the violence there with his family and lived in a refugee camp for years before founding a school for camp children. Kenneth Mukonyeze became a soldier in his native Uganda, but decided to leave the military and join the opposition party, even though he was jailed for a time, when he saw Uganda's leader violently abuse power to hold on to it.
So it's like if I would remain silent or continue remaining silent, I would be a problem to the future of every child. So I really stood up, sympathized with members of the opposition, even though I was not so sure that they could really come to solve the problem. But I believe we needed the
change. Was that scary? You know, you were probably in the safer place, the place of power. You're in the military. Is that scary to realize that an opposition that you're maybe even being asked to put down may be right?
Yeah, if there is any gift that I would give to my daughter, is risking my life for her future.
It is now too dangerous for Kenneth to stay in Uganda, so he's studying conflict transformation in Vermont. Taman Al-Boutif is a member of the minority Druze community in Syria. As the civil war in Syria worsened, he fled the country, lived for a while in a refugee community in Turkey before coming to the States to continue his studies. Abdu Idris is from the Darfur Kordofan region of Sudan. What a journey he's had. A community organizer who focused on securing land rights for impoverished rural peasants, he was forced to flee to Egypt, where he worked in Cairo with the large Sudanese refugee population. He told us about meeting a woman in jail. She'd been arrested for trying the dangerous Mediterranean crossing to Europe with her four children.
You have a children. This is very risk for you to go to Europe by boat because maybe you can die. She told me, Abdu, I have been raped in my country during the conflict. And here I try to work to make a better life for these children. She get domestic violence. She told me that I believe in the sea as a safe haven better than human beings.
The sea as a safe haven.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then there was Fadia Thabet. She grew up in a middle-class family in Yemen, which is now enduring not just a long-running civil war between the governing Houthis and rebels that's displacing thousands and producing hunger, disease, child soldiers, but terrorist groups in other countries have filled the country's vacuum, fighting over the spoils. Fadia worked with former child soldiers and eventually had to leave Yemen and leave her family behind. This year, she received the International Woman of Courage Award from First Lady Melania Trump. I started by asking her about that award. You said that you were even worried about receiving the award because you were targeted. Who would target you?
So back in my country in 2011, I worked against AQAP, Al-Qaeda and Ben Saleh in Yemen when they occupied one of the governorates in the south. And then afterwards, I continue working against the government who committed also human rights violations. And with the recent conflict, I documented most of the cases, whether they're the Houthis or the Saudis. So, I mean, basically all of them. So it was really hard to just, like, receive the award. But I was thinking about, like, within this, I guess, the political atmosphere is here in the U.S., how we can just, like, send a different message about women refugees and or women who came to the U.S.
You were pictured with Melania Trump. Did you speak to her about, you know, your concerns about refugees? You're nodding yes.
You are not the only one who asked these questions. Actually, we had maybe less than 45 seconds to speak to her. It was just only, like, also hectic. She came and she shook our hands. She congratulated most of the awardees. And then we just, like, went to the event.
What would you want to say?
I really wanted to say that, can you just, like, listen to the youth? Can you have more women around peace talks? We actually have solutions how we can bring peace. It's a different, completely different than yours, but we are coming from an experience on the ground, while you're just, like, a lot of NGOs or United Nations, just, like, they're writing the reports behind the desk, but we are the one who actually went through this experience. And people are willing, whether that they are tribes or civil society, they are willing to achieve peace. But we are not targeting the grassroots. We're just, like, targeting the governments and the Houthis, which is representing just only 5 or 6 people from the whole populations.
Talk about your work, especially with child soldiers. Someone here in this evening asked, how do you bring empathy to the table? And ultimately, everyone said, you listen. Really, you listen to a child soldier who has murdered, who has raped? You're nodding.
Yeah, I mean, I received calls when we started our program. I received calls from those kids. They wanted to go back to their community, but some of them couldn't because the crimes that they committed, or some of them being just, like, they know that the community will isolate them because they were part of this terrorist group. To be honest with you, it was risky, very, very risky. We just, like, received an unknown call from a bunch of kids, and they just, like, we were child soldiers, and we want to be part of our communities. We don't want to be part of Al-Qaeda or Houthis again. How are you going to help us? We prepared everything. It wasn't just, like, something definite that, you know, it might be a trap. We couldn't know that it was actually something solid. We just, like, we follow our instincts. We did what we could. We just, like, but if they reach us, that means they need help. They need an assistance. They need us. We can do that. They believed in us. Let's believe in them.
It was so clear. Your point is they may be participating in terrorism, mm-hmm. but they are victims.
They are victims. When the country is in a chaos and collapsing, you lost all your resources. You don't have an income. Some of them being pushed by their moms to just, like, secure an income for 7 siblings. And if you hear them, it's just like, I heard a lot of stories and I was just like, oh my gosh. But they actually targeted. They know who they targeted. They actually targeted low-income children who've been just, like, with a single mom.
The young kids that are recruited.
Yes, yeah. So, and they pay the price. To be honest with you, the kids, they already pay the price. Whether that they lost their hands, their eyes. I had to work with a couple of organizations to provide the artificial parts. But the scar is still there. Every time that they will wake up in the morning, the scar is there. So the trauma is just, like, you can't describe it. And it takes a long time to work with them and just, like, reintegrate them to the society.
It was really interesting to hear you were sitting next to Abdu Idris, who was a refugee from Sudan. And he'd been tortured in prison because he was trying to work there to help support war victims and eventually had to become a refugee. But he was talking about kids as young as 14 from Sudan
who are actually sort of exported, I think is the word we came up with, from Sudan, paid for by Saudi Arabia to go fight in Yemen. Mm-hmm. Sudan has no dog in that battle. Mm-hmm. And yet here he's watching young people from his country being sent to fight in your country.
Yeah. The kids who joined Al-Qaeda or the Houthis, they were 10 years old. 10 years old, some of them 9 years old. So, and we recently, we witnessed a lot of videos, and many countries are part of the conflict in Yemen, not just only Sudan. We had also like Malaysia now. We had the whole coalition is part of the, leading by the Saudis and supporting and backing by the US and UK by all these weapons. So I guess it's just like what I describe it, it's a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Yemeni civilians, they don't have absolutely nothing. They are not gaining anything from this war. They are losing. We have now cholera, humanitarian workers being targeted. People who speak against the Houthis, they've been, their house has been blown up or just like assassined.
We talked a lot about guilt. Mm-hmm. The man to your right was from Uganda. He was tortured in prison. His family is still there being abused. Mm-hmm. And he feels this tremendous guilt sitting up in beautiful, bucolic Vermont. You're studying, you're working, you're getting ready for the next chapter, but is it just crazy-making sometimes to be... I can't imagine the disconnect for you.
It is a lot of guilt. When I received the award, and when I just, like, they told me about winning the award, they told my family, change the address, go somewhere else. They've been just, like, fleeing from a house to another. I had to change my last name before I came to the U.S. I had to delete all my social media to just secure myself and secure my family. I'm not posting anything. I'm trying to just, like, because I know that I'm safe and I'm guilty, but I'm all the time thinking about them, how I can just, like, make sure that nothing happened to them. So it's a lot of guilt.
Thaddea Thabit, one of the 5 refugees in the first class of global scholars at World Learning, the School for International Training in Brattleboro, Vermont. To see pictures and for more on the program, go to hereandnow.org.
The stock market has had a volatile week so far. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 200 points yesterday. It bounced back somewhat this morning. Joining us now is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And experts are saying there are a few reasons for this drop, including fears about North Korea.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's obviously not always possible to say with 100% certainty what's causing markets to move. But North Korea certainly appears to be the main catalyst of yesterday's volatility. And it's sort of a similar pattern that we've seen for the last month or so, wherein North Korea does something very provocative, or President Trump responds to them with something provocative, and the market quickly sells off, only to rebound relatively quickly. So it goes to show you that this is a risk that markets are very much attuned to, but it's very tricky to price in, and it's hard to know when the saber rattling has gone beyond just that, when it's more than just noise.
Right, especially when you've got President Trump saying that he would end trade with all countries that are doing business with North Korea, which of course would mean China, which is a big trading partner of the U.S.
Exactly, exactly. And the sort of unpredictable nature of both sides, I think, tends to, you know, keep investors on guard about this issue.
Now, another big question mark out there, as it has been all along, is the president's proposals to change the tax code. It seems like the market goes up when investors think he will be able to do that, and goes down when it doesn't look so likely. Are investors starting to worry that the president won't be able to cut taxes like he wants to?
I think a lot of that optimism about a big sweeping tax cut has sort of seeped out of the market to some degree. So when it does look like it's potentially back on, there is a pretty positive reaction. But the more acute issue yesterday was definitely the idea of the debt ceiling. And it's an issue that's been complicated somewhat by the need for Congress to provide hurricane relief to Texas, and also the White House announcing it was ordering an end to the DACA program. So that sort of raised the temperature on the partisan bickering yesterday. So today, when the news came out that Trump and Congress are near a deal to pass Harvey aid and a debt limit increase, that allowed people to exhale a little bit on that issue. And that's sort of why the market is recovering today.
Well, and when we talk about a 200-plus point drop in the Dow that we saw yesterday, we should remember we're still near record levels in the Dow overall. But maybe there's just some fear out there that the good times might be coming to an end.
Yeah, exactly. And remember, the higher the Dow goes, the less meaningful a 200-point drop is.
Right.
The market's last record was in early August, and the volatility over the last month or so, we've really only lost at most about 2.5 to 3% in the Dow and the S&P 500. But it does feel worse than that because the market has been so calm. I always compare it to the weather in Atlanta. You know, if it snows a couple inches in Atlanta, people freak out more than they would at a couple inches of snow in Boston. So I think that's kind of the backdrop for why people are looking at this volatility and taking a little bit more seriously than they would otherwise.
Just a few seconds left, but we learned today that Stanley Fischer, the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, is resigning. Is that a big deal?
It is definitely a big deal on Wall Street. I mean, Fisher's 73 years old. His term was due to be up next year, next June. But obviously, Wall Street likes to try to read between the lines on something like this. And there's just a lot of uncertainty now about who will be leading policy at the Fed next year.
That's Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The Florida Keys, 43 islands connected by bridges with just one small main road up to the north, have been through many storms, but few as big as Irma, now a Category 5 hurricane. Tourists on the Keys are under a mandatory evacuation, and 70,000 or so year-round residents will start tonight at 7 p.m. And somehow, Monroe County Emergency Management Director Martin Centerfit found a second for us. Martin, thank you. And do we understand that you're not even going to open shelters because there are so few places in the Keys that are safe?
That's correct. Because we are an island county, all of our islands are so low level, there are no buildings in Monroe County that can meet the national standards for shelters, and therefore our county has to evacuate to the mainland for all hurricane storms, especially Category 3 through 5.
Yeah, even your Emergency Operations Center in Marathon can't withstand a Cat 5, but we do understand, I mean, some of you officials have to stay behind. And that you'll be going to, what, some newer high schools?
Well, that is kind of a last-case effort. What we will do is we will have to evacuate this EOC when the storm gets closer.
Your center.
And we will still evacuate probably 99% of our emergency workers and EOC staff. So there may be just a few people stay behind, but there will be no sheltering whatsoever within the county.
Well, boy, this is really quite something. Are you nervous about whether people will heed the call to go?
Yes, that's always the concern. People start getting locked on these six-hour track changes, and they keep just waiting for the next six-hour segment to maybe get some better news. And then that's when that tragedy unfolds that we've all seen so many times on the news. As you know, we can't help but wonder, why did people stay? Why were they still there? Well, because they get caught in this pattern of praying for a track change. The truth is we no longer have time to hope for another track change. Now is the time to evacuate. It's as simple as that.
Right.
We're out of time. You need to evacuate now.
And you'd rather have the storm suddenly, flip a U-ey and everybody be scoffing at you than be sitting there if it doesn't. Look, even your hospitals, there are three hospitals there, are evacuating.
That's correct. And that's the reality of emergency management. We want to be wrong. We want the storm to miss us. But the actions we're taking are not wrong. They're the proper actions at the proper time. And we pray that this storm will continue to track to the east and will not hit anybody. But, boy, that's a foolish way to be thinking right now. You've got to be thinking about safety first.
Right. Look, in Houston, everybody was looking over at Galveston and the historic hurricane that hit there years ago. Are people there talking about the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, one of the biggest to ever hit the U.S., winds over 180 miles an hour, ships grounded, cars from a railway relief train swept from the tracks, most of the Upper Keys destroyed?
That's right. We talk here about the 35 hurricane that you just mentioned. We also remind people of 1960 Hurricane Donna, where a storm category 4 storm came up and hit right between Key Largo and Marathon. So the history is there that we can be hit. The science is saying that we can be hit. And finally, the experts are saying we can be hit. That's a triple win there. We have to listen to what they're saying.
Look, even the animal shelter is evacuating 89 cats, 24 dogs, 23 rabbits, 8 turtles, a chicken, a parakeet. That's in Key West. In Marathon, 43 cats, dogs, 4 turtles, and 3 iguanas are leaving. So nothing is staying behind.
Well, no, that does leave about 6 million iguanas still behind. But if three of them are leaving, at least the iguanas will be safe.
That's Monroe County Emergency Management Director Martin Centerfit in the Florida Keys as he's evacuating people. Martin, we wish you and everybody in the Keys just all the best.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Well, as Irma approaches, we, of course, are keeping a close eye on Texas and Louisiana, where a massive cleanup is underway after Harvey. Many small towns in East Texas saw record flooding, including LaGrange, located between Austin and Houston, which was flooded when the Colorado River crested nearly 30 feet above its banks. Many of the town's 5,000 residents evacuated. Audrey McGlinchey of member station KUT met with some of them after they returned to begin dealing with this damage.
When residents of LaGrange returned home, many began ripping apart their houses.
Pulling the walls out, gotta let it breathe, gotta let it dry out inside the walls.
I went to Kayla Barnett's house on North River Street. Her stepdad, Rob Behrens, and a family friend were piling debris onto a muddy mound of belongings. A mattress, pillows, a string of twinkly cactus lights.
And how far did the water get up to?
Behrens points to a line on the wall.
Right up about here.
That's crazy. I'm 5'6". That seems like seven foot six.
7.5 feet of water. With damage like that, the house has got to get down to its skeleton. You don't want to take any chances on mold.
Yeah, well, right now we're just going to pull everything out. Toilets and bathtubs and pull the sink out. Obviously, the kitchen cabinets aren't going to be anything left. Everything's made out of particle board these days, so it's just going to fall apart.
Behrens goes back to stripping out insulation. I head down the street. The welcome mat outside the home offers me a spongy goodbye. On LaGrange's main street, there's a blue bulldozer sitting outside what's left of the Fayetteville Bank Financial Center. Men carry out a soggy rug.
We're just ripping everything out.
We're going up with taking the sheetrock out up 6 foot.
Jason Marburger says it's surreal to be stripping this building.
He framed it. This building, what did we say a while ago? It was finished about 9 months ago.
It started in June of last year. And then it was through in January, and it moved in February. Something.
So it's about 9 months that it was in business.
Is it weird to be kind of undoing your own work? Or
another worker, Larry Voschik, answers.
A lot of times we remodel a house, it might be 30 years later. And now this is just a year, 9 months.
He shakes his head. I walk outside to get some air. If you've never been in a water-damaged building, the stench can be overwhelming. Sewage mixed with the smell of a wet dog. Outside, there's a muddy toilet on the lawn. I meet Greg Ferguson, who worked at the Fayetteville Bank Financial Center.
When we built this, they made us build 3 feet up because of the flood zone. And I laughed at them. I said, y'all got to be kidding me. No way in the world is it ever going to flood out here. The contractor said the same thing. And here what? Took us 2 years from the ground starting this thing. And it wiped out.
I head back down River Street. A one-story yellow home is being gutted. Erica Martinez shows me around her parents' house.
This was my brother's room. It's really dark in here.
The electricity's been out since the flood.
We had a dresser here, and it literally just bent it. It just bent it.
In half?
Yeah.
We go into her parents' closet. On a top shelf stand some of the few items that remain dry.
What are those things?
Like my dad has papers, and he has some of his cowboy hats and my stepmom's bags and stuff. But everything else is gone. Yeah.
And that's just probably about 8 feet, I would guess.
Yeah, I would say so, because I'm 5'1".
In the living room, Erica's stepmom, Dolores, is leaning over plastic bins of family photos. They're streaked with mud. She shows me one. It was taken on her quinceañera. Martinez is dressed in a white gown. About a dozen older family members flank her in the nearly 40-year-old photo.
You can see it's not salvable, but if I can take a picture with my phone, at least I'll have, a memory.
When Martinez and her family evacuated before the storm, they each packed a bag of clothes. They expected a little bit of flooding.
We said, let's leave things up on the table and put things on the bed. Maybe we'll come back to a foot of water or two, there's no reason for the 8 feet of water that the house got.
Mud still cakes the floor. Martinez and I peer out the open window at volunteers from a local high school wiping down her muddied furniture in the backyard. Most of it will have to be thrown away.
Right now, you know, it's all I can do. Just pretend like this is a dream and that I need to work in the dream I'm working. And I have a lot of wonderful people in this community.
Martinez tells me that when she moved into the house 15 years ago, it was much smaller. The family saved up over time to build onto the home. Now they'll most likely have to rebuild.
It's a long time that it took us to get us to where we're at right now. And for 48 hours, it's gone. You know, it took us a lifetime to get all these things, so.
Martinez, like many others I spoke to in LaGrange, does not have flood insurance. I leave her peering into another plastic bin. This one's full of porcelain angels her mother bought her in Spain. Surprisingly, the angels were untouched by the muddy waters. For Here and Now, I'm Audrey McGlinchey.
This is back to school week in many places. College freshmen are adjusting to college life, and many high school seniors are focusing on college applications and asking for letters of recommendation. Joining us now is Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, my high school. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and the students are coming back to campus across the country. So what is your advice to college freshmen about how to adjust to academic life, which can be very different than what they've experienced in high school?
Especially if they have had a lot of their past experiences in high school managed by their parents, by their guardians. So it's a lot of self-advocacy tips, Jeremy. We're trying to tell these kids, you got to step up. You have to be the one to reach out to people when you need help.
What do you mean by self-advocacy?
For instance, I'm amazed at how many professors that I speak with will say we have office hours and no one comes to them. So we try to tell students, don't be afraid. Your professors are there. They want to meet with you. They have office hours. You have an RA in the dormitory, the residence halls. Talk to that person. You have academic advisors that may be full-time professionals that are there to actually help you think about your course requests, your dreams, your goals. And there's career services. And I'm amazed at how many students don't even know about those resources or take advantage of them.
What about the workload? How do you get used to the college workload, which may not be as structured as you're used to?
You know, I sometimes go back to old pen and pencil activities. So when I meet with a freshman who's struggling, I will often get out a sheet of paper, and it literally is a grid marked from 6 a.m. in the morning to maybe 2 a.m. in the morning. And I'll say, for a week, just show me what you're doing. How are you spending your time? Because time management is so important, and I want them to realize there's no guilt involved if they want to put in that they're going to watch their favorite television show, or they're going to do Skype with a friend that moved out of state and they want to keep in touch. Keeping those things that are important in your life managed in your life are important, but it is amazing, especially with social media, how distractions can take away a lot of your time. And when they take control of their day, Jeremy, they have more time than they thought.
Okay, so some things for college freshmen to think about. What about high school seniors as they are starting their final school year in high school? You say it's time to think about recommendation letters. Explain.
Yeah, and for some high schools, I mean, I know there are many schools that maybe give their students tips to start talking to teachers junior year, because I think most students are getting letters from teachers who taught them in 11th grade. But the reality is you have to follow your school's policies on when teachers are actually willing and eager to talk with you about letters. So for the majority of the high school seniors, now is the time for them to start reaching out to at least two academic teachers that can really write deeply about how they think in the classroom, how they do things that go beyond normal classroom expectations, so that the college really gets some nice anecdotal stories about how this kid thinks deeply.
Does it matter what kind of person you're asking for a recommendation from? Does it matter if it's a band teacher versus a calculus teacher?
Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously what we talk about as letters of rec are about personal connections. So I get it. I get if you literally have known the band instructor for 4 years and you want that person. But that person will probably have to write as what's called a supplement letter. The academic letters do have to come from the cores. It has to be English, math, science, social studies, or foreign language. But it is very common nowadays for colleges that actually ask for letters to realize that there may be a voice out there that the student actually feels like knows them the best, and they will allow the boss from the part-time job. They'll allow the yearbook instructor. They'll allow the band director.
How many recommendations do most students need?
Usually it's two required, which is academic teachers plus the school counselor. I think what we try to coach our families on is realizing it's not about overwhelming the file with six extra letters. It's really about thinking who knows you in this high school year experience. And oftentimes we say to students, think deeply about who you really think knows you best. And let's say, Jeremy, they come up to me and they say, Lisa, I can't decide. I literally have five people that I want to write for me. Mm. And the college only accepts three. I will say to the student, well, who are those extra two letters that you're not going to be able to get? And maybe they can send me an email, send me a quote or two. I am happy to incorporate that into my counselor letter. So we're very eager to talk with students so that they feel comfortable knowing that various voices are going to be representing them.
Now, I remember when I got letters of recommendation, I really wanted to see what they said, right? But should you waive your right of access to do that?
I love that question, and we get asked that all the time. And sadly, there's some bad advice that is often posted or shared with students that say, oh, no, ask 10 teachers, read all 10, pick the two that are strongest and use those. That is the worst advice that they can ever hear. They really should employ a life skill, and that is trust the person who's writing for you. Because if you don't waive your right of access, the college will know that. And that waters down the letter. Hmm. The colleges may actually think that you insisted on rewriting it for the adult. So students and parents, I beg you, waive your right of access. Give legitimacy to that letter and show that you trust that adult who's recommending you. If they can't recommend you, they shouldn't be writing your letter.
Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois, will link you to some of Lisa's tips for students and families at hereandnow.org. Lisa, thanks.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Fascinating, Jeremy. And by the way, I've written letters of recommendation for young people. And yeah, if it's great, I send it to them. You don't have to ask. I give it to them.
But you're not supposed to do that. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It is Here and Now.